Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Texas Gulf Coast, August 1840.
He was Comanche, and he was known among the people as Buffalo Caller. Once, in a time of hunger, when he was a fledgling on one of his first hunts, the older and more experienced men had ridden their horses to exhaustion without scaring up so much as one lone, lame bull. But Buffalo Caller, riding alone, had heard a faint and distant bellow. He had responded in the voice of a buffalo, and the buffalo had answered him. The calls led him to a small herd in a hidden canyon. It was not buffalo he hunted now. He scouted as a wolf for the largest assembly of raiders the Penetooka Band had ever put together, moving to strike the land-greedy, hare-faced American settlers of Texas. Beside him, against the Texans, rode Swift as the Antelope, so named for his fleetness of foot. Buffalo Caller tingled with excitement over the sights he was about to behold. He had never seen an ocean or even a boat, so it strained his imagination to visualize what old men had described around their campfires. Where he rode now was far to the south and east of the short grass prairie and the limestone hill hunting grounds he was accustomed to roaming. A journey of many days had brought the massive Comanche war column into a gently rolling land of sandy soil and tall, summer-cured grass, much different from the higher, drier land the Penetookas claimed as home. Summer heat sent sweat rolling down from beneath his buffalo horn headdress and into his paint-streaked face, burning his eyes. What they were about was vengeance, blood for blood. In the early spring, many tribal leaders and warriors had met with white chiefs in San Antonio de Bahar's council house to discuss an earlier agreement by the Comanches to free all their captives. Some had reconsidered the promise and balked, holding out for stronger terms. Talk had led to quarrel, and quarrel to the loosing of arrows and an explosion of gunfire. When the smoke drifted away, more than 30 Indians lay dead and dying in the council house and in the foul dirt of San Antonio's narrow streets. In retaliation, the Comanches had killed most of the remaining white captives, but those had not bled enough to wash away the stain of the San Antonio disaster. The indignant Penetookas had undertaken this huge, punitive expedition, carrying them far beyond their normal range, all the way eastward to the Gulf of Mexico. He did not know how many of the people were on this grand adventure. He had attempted to count them on his fingers and thumbs, but the task overwhelmed him. Their horses left the grass beaten down, and the ground scarred in their wake like the slow passage of a large buffalo herd. Though the object was war, many women and children had come along to watch and cheer as their warriors carried calamity to the white enemy. Mexican allies guided them, for they knew the route. They knew how to pick their way through the sparsely settled region and avoid detection until it was time for the great force to loose its thunder and lightning. Buffalo Caller understood that the Americans had won this land from the Mexicans in a fierce war. Mexico wanted to take it back and had sent emissaries to the tribes, promising many good things in return for their aid. Buffalo Caller cared nothing for Mexico, but he welcomed any chance to strike the Texans. A temporary alliance with a former adversary was justifiable if it promised victory over an enemy hated even more. Beside him, Antelope motioned for Buffalo Caller to stop.
The wind brings the smell of smoke.
Buffalo Caller smelled only dust, for the ground was so dry it had cracked open in places. The soil would all be up and moving on the wind were it not bound by a heavy stand of brittle grass, the result of last spring's rains. He drew the skin taut at the edge of his right eye, trying to sharpen his vision. Antelope was right.
I think I see a house. It is beyond the timber there.
If they have horses, we shall take them.
Antelope, taking horses is not what you and I have been sent to do.
The principal concern so far had been to avoid premature detection as the army of warriors moved along. The wolves were to overtake and kill any whites who might observe their passage before the trap was sprung. That precaution seemed less important now because scouts had reported that the town of Victoria lay only a short distance ahead. The Americans would soon know of the column's coming. One Mexican guide had lived in Victoria until the Texans drove him out, and he itched for retribution. Victoria had been chosen as the first target. Buffalo Caller recognized Antelope's determination. He relented, knowing Antelope would do whatever he wanted, regardless of advice to the contrary.
If we find horses, there is no reason they should not be ours.
If we find any tables, we will take their scalps as well as their horses.
So long as we do not leave our own.
Emerging from a small patch of timber, they saw a man afoot in a cornfield, wielding a curved knife to cut heads from the stalks, tossing them into the bed of a wagon drawn by two horses. His back turned, he did not see the warrior's approach.
You take the horses, Buffalo Caller. I will take the man.
Not until he heard the hooves did the farmer turn. He wasted a long moment, frozen in startled disbelief, as the two Comanches rushed down upon him. Then he ran for the rail fence. Antelope quickly aimed his arrow. The warrior leaped from his horse and knelt beside the dying man. Holding his knife, Antelope pulled the man's hair back, exposing the line of his scalp. Antelope took the scalp and moved toward Buffalo Caller. Buffalo Caller had cut the two horses loose from the wagon. They were docile. What human beings did to one another concerned them little. Antelope raised the bloody trophy for Buffalo Caller to observe, then looked toward the log cabin.
There may be others.
We have the horses. That is what we came for.
If you leave one hornet, it will rebuild the nest.
But if they fire upon us, we must leave. We can do no good for anyone if we are dead.
It was not that he feared death, but the life he was living here gave him pleasure. He was yet young, and so were his two wives. They silently approached by way of the barn, larger than the cabin, and built of rough boards instead of logs. His gaze was focused on the house, for if there was to be trouble, it would come from there. Antelope touched his arm and pointed in silence. Beneath a roof that extended beyond the barn, a woman sat on a stool, milking a cow. Like the man, she faced away from the Indians and was unaware of them. The two warriors moved toward a log fence that separated them from the barn. Buffalo Caller climbed to the top. The woman looked around, saw him, and jumped to her feet. She ran to the barn door, then turned, a pitchfork in her hands. He entertained the thought of taking her along, for his wives would welcome a slave woman to bear the weight of some of their labors. Two, he had never taken a Tabo woman into his blankets, and he wondered how different one might be. But she came at him with the pitchfork, and he had no choice. He fitted an arrow to the bowstring. He had noticed from the first that her hair was reddish, like the hair of a buffalo calf. He knelt over her and lifted a strand of it, wondering if she might have colored it somehow. But none of the color came off on his fingers. It would be a great curiosity when he showed it to his friends. Buffalo Caller turned toward the barn and brought another arrow out of the quiver. He stopped, for in the doorway stood a small boy with hair redder than his mother's. Buffalo Caller could only stare.
Are you frightened of a baby? I will kill him for you if you are afraid.
I am not afraid. But I have never seen hair of such a color. Not on a human being.
We will keep the scalp.
No. My wives have given me only girl babies so far. I will take this boy for a son.
And carry him into the fight? He will burden you.
But I can teach him to be a good hunter. He could keep us from hunger when we are old.
A white-skinned Panatuka with hair like fire. Who ever saw such a thing?
The buffalo will not care about the color of his hair.
We should kill him. The color of his hair is like blood. It could sour our medicine.
What has hair to do with medicine?
The boy looked in bewilderment at his mother's body. Buffalo Caller picked him up and tucked him under his right arm.
I cannot tolerate a squalling child. If he cries, I will cut his throat.
Buffalo Caller drew his own knife.
You will have to cut mine first.
Then do not let him cry.
This one is too brave to cry. Now let us go. We do not want to miss the big fight.
First, I will burn the house. If you are wise, you will kill that red-haired boy.
Go on. Set your fire.
Graphic Audio presents Elmer Kelton's Texas Rangers series. Performed by Terrence Aselford, David Coyne, Richard Rowan, Thomas Penny, Tim Getman, Jonathan Watkins, Christopher Graybill, Scott McCormick, Michael John Casey, Catherine Aselford, Ken Jackson, James Lewis, Andy Clements, Nanette Savard, Joe Brack, Casey Platt, Michael Glenn, James Konacek, Eric Messner, Colleen Delaney, Tim Carlin, Yasmin Toison, Tony Nam, Dylan Lynch, Tom Simpson, Laura Reichert, Johann Detweiler, and Mort Shelby. Texas Rangers number 1, The Buckskin Line. After camping along a creek, they had continued on their way, driving the great band of captured horses and mules from Victoria, their first target. Many Tabos had died in the small town, but Buffalo Caller had a feeling Linville would provide an even greater vengeance. The warriors were painted and ready for battle, for the paint carried strong medicine and helped ward off bullets. Buffalo Caller looked back toward the direction where the women and children waited with the horses. He had turned his small captive over to the care of his younger wife, Whippoorwill. Linville was a tiny but prosperous seaport, with several warehouses holding goods brought in by ship for wagon and cart transport to such inland towns as San Antonio and Nacogdoches. As had been the case in Victoria, the townspeople took little notice of the approaching warriors. Buffalo Caller guessed the huge horse and mule herd had misled them into assuming the visitors were traders like the Mexicans at Victoria, bringing animals to barter or sell. The townsfolk were too late to mount a defense. By dozens, they scrambled toward the shore. Men, women, and children ran in desperation. They piled into small boats tied to the wooden pier and frantically rowed away into the sea. Farther out, Buffalo Caller saw what appeared to be a large house floating, a curl of black smoke rising from its tall chimney. Beyond the steamship, he could see nothing but water and more water, endless to the horizon, reflecting the sunlight and burning his eyes. He stared in wonder. People had told him of such strange things, wooden houses that sat atop the water, but he had never quite believed them.
Buffalo Caller! Too many are getting away!
Antelope forced his horse out into the surf, trying to catch one of the boats. Buffalo Caller followed. The town lay open and defenseless, awaiting the raiders' pleasure. Several townspeople lay dead in the streets, caught and killed before they could reach the boats. Buffalo Caller moved toward a large building a short distance from the docks. The Mexican guides had promised that the warehouses would be full of goods wondrous beyond imagination. The people could take whatever they wanted and be welcomed to it. There was no shame in stealing from Texans, the biggest thieves of all. Some of the boats went all the way out to the ship that lay offshore. Others stopped and simply floated along out of range, their passengers watching helplessly while the town fell to the invaders like wild plums dropping from a tree. Warriors who had followed them into the surf had turned back to begin a joyous plundering of homes and warehouses. Buffalo Caller entered a store and marveled at the variety of treasures it offered. He had tasted apples in San Antonio, and he found a barrelful here. On the shelves, he found rolls of cloth, some plain, others in bright colors. Antelope yanked down a bolt of red material and began to unfold it, wrapping it around his shoulders and waist. He picked up a stovepipe hat and jammed it onto his head, bending a feather he wore tied into his braided black hair. Buffalo Caller thought Antelope looked ridiculous. He would not trade his buffalo headdress for all the hats in the store. However, he spotted some cloth upon a shelf that he was sure would please his wives.
We should hurry.
Other warriors were setting fire to houses as they finished their looting. They had packed many of the captured horses and mules with goods taken from Linville homes, stores, and warehouses. Many of the men wore white man clothes, hats of various descriptions. Antelope had even placed a hat on his horse's head after cutting slits so it would fit over the ears. Hardly a building remained intact. A heavy pall of dark smoke hung over the town. Linville would be little but ashes and ruin when its citizens mustered the courage to row back from the sea. Then they would know the true price of Texan treachery. It mattered not that the people here probably had nothing to do with what happened in the San Antonio Council House. They were white. In the eyes of the Comanche, the people, vengeance against one enemy was vengeance against all. They had no patience with individual responsibility, separating the guilty from the innocent. All their enemies were guilty. Buffalo Caller noted that the head of the column was moving in a northwesterly direction. That pleased him. In a few days, he would be back in the familiar and pleasant surroundings of his own country. He thought of the boy he had taken and the pleasure a son would bring to his lodge, even one whose hair was red. Warren Webb enjoyed riding alongside Michael Shannon on the wagon road to Linville. The jovial farmer was pleasant company, never short of stories to tell. It mattered not whether they were totally true or were partly a construction of an imagination enriched by Shannon's 30 years or so of drifting from Tennessee across Arkansas and Louisiana and finally down the Texas coast. He had entered into every conflict he could reach, however far it might have been out of his way. Mike Shannon had never seen a fight he did not want to mix into, bringing all the gusto other men put into games and horse races. Though summer heat made each mile seem like two, conversation helped relieve the weight of fatigue. And if Shannon's speech easily lapsed into the profane, that too afforded its guilty pleasures. For Webb was a circuit-riding minister whose small farm was sadly neglected because of the travel requirements of his higher calling. Coming from someone else, a little profanity offered a tantalizing hint of wickedness. A minor and harmless rebellion he found refreshing. Shannon seemed little inhibited by the fact that his riding companion was a man of the cloth who carried the word far past the forks of the creek where settlers could not afford a live-there preacher.
By God, Preacher Webb, this country's getting so choked up with people, they'll pretty soon be stumbling all over one another. I'm studying on moving west out on the Colorado River. There's land to be had out there, not half so dear as this on the coast.
Surely you'd not depart our midst before you've harvested your crop.
And leave the fruits of my labor for somebody who never broke a sweat? Old Mother Shannon never raised no half-wit sons, by God. I figure we'll leave in the fall and locate us a place. I'll break the land this winter and have her ready to seed in the spring.
I'd not mind following after you, Mike. I've an itch to be seeing new country.
Come with us, then. There's fever in this low ground, and I've noted you've got an unhealthy cough. There's others moving out yonder. Where there's people, there's a need for somebody to teach the ways of the Lord, lest they go heathen. It ain't good to stay in one place too long. Dulls a man. You wear out one farm, you move on to another. That's what the Lord put the land here for.
I don't know that he meant for us to wear it out.
He must have, by God, because he gave us so much. There ain't no end to it.
Shannon made a broad sweep with his arm toward a horizon, flat and endless. For a while, Webb had been aware of a tan cloud hovering low in the northeast. He at first thought it might be a dust storm because the weather had turned dry of late, but it occurred to him that the wind did not seem strong enough to raise that much dust. Besides, the cloud appeared localized, moving slowly westward.
Kind of odd doings yonder, don't you think?
Seems to be an out-of-the-way place for traders to be taking the Ramuda. Might be a group of immigrants, straight off the main trail to look for grass.
If so, maybe they're in the mood to hear the word. It might be me and you could get us a woman-cooked meal.
You had a woman-cooked breakfast this morning. Your Dora is as good a cook as ever I ate after.
But I can't remember the last time I had a cup of real coffee that wasn't stretched out with parched grain. Maybe them folks have got some.
Webb had intended to be at the Linville settlement by dark, but he supposed tomorrow would be soon enough. If these people were in need of preaching, it was his obligation to offer it.
Let's go see about that coffee.
First sight of the horses aroused a strange sense of foreboding, a queasy feeling of finding himself in the wrong place.
Did you ever see so many in one bunch, Mike?
Something queer looking about this. They ain't no traders, and they ain't no movers. What they are is Indians, by God.
Webb could not believe this at first. The only Indians he had seen this near the coast had been small gatherings of Tonkawas, the poorest, raggedest people he had ever encountered, come to barter or beg. Folks said they could be ferocious as hungry wolves against their enemies, the Comanches, and that they even had cannibalistic tendencies. To him, they appeared harmless, except for a little sticky-fingered thievery. These were not Tonkawas.
I hope you have favor in the eyes of your maker. He'd better not let them see us before we get in that timber yonder.
Webb thought it prudent to be running while he consulted the Lord. It seemed impossible that they were not discovered, but the passing Indians gave no sign they had noticed.
Huh, they think we're part of their bunch.
Our clothes and hats ought to tell them different.
Well, a lot of them are wearing hats too, the store-bought kind. I bet you a U.S. dollar they didn't buy them. Looks to me like there's a couple thousand horses and mules and maybe 1,000 Indians. Odd thing is they've got squaws and children with them.
But who are they? Where'd they come from?
Comanches. And I'd guess they're fresh from looting the hell out of someplace. Heading back to their own country now, most likely.
God pity any poor souls they happen upon along their way.
Well, there's some farms out yonder, the direction they're traveling. They'll gobble up them folks like wolves gobble a rabbit.
We could circle around ahead of them, give warning. How's your fate?
Strong enough, as long as I'm riding with a preacher. The Lord ain't gonna let nothing happen to you.
They don't seem to be in a hurry or worried about anybody jumping them.
I'd feel safe too if I was them. Take an army to jump a bunch the size of that.
Riding at an angle away from the Indian column, the two remained within the cover of the timber to its southern edge. Webb looked back.
We ought to be far enough now.
As they paralleled the Comanches, Shannon glanced warily in one direction, then the other.
They didn't pick all them doodads and all them horses and mules off the trees. I'd wager they left a string of dead folks behind them.
First, we need to look after the ones still alive. I'll pray for the others when I have the time.
At the first farm, they found a man and his wife working in a garden just south of a log cabin. The farmer had listened to their report with suspicion.
Bunch of Indians that size don't seem likely. You sure you didn't just see him in a bottle?
I've been known to sip a little whiskey now and again. But Brother Webb don't drink, nor is he given to lying. Take a look at that dust coming yonder. It ain't no sea breeze, by God.
But Comanches is close to the coast? Must be a bunch of Tonks or maybe Karankawas.
There ain't that many Karankawas in the whole nation. Wouldn't make no difference anyway. One'll kill you as dead as the other. You gotta get out of here.
Martha, get the young'uns ready. I'll hitch up the team.
The woman rushed into the cabin. The farmer pointed.
You'll find the Johnson family over that away, where you see that stand of trees. Old man Blessing and his boys are about a mile or so further on. They're the last ones I know of in that direction.
The Johnsons had required no persuasion. Webb had known the young family at camp meeting, and they accepted his word. Abner Blessing, on the other hand, wasn't ready to move. He was a towering, raw-boned farmer whose broad shoulders appeared to sag under their own weight. The Blessings had built their cabin of stone, befitting a family of great strength. He pointed to his three grown sons, all rough-cut out of raw oak in his image.
Me and my boys ain't giving up our place. We'll take our stand behind them stone walls.
You just as well try to wipe out a hornet's nest with a sharp stick. I don't doubt your fighting spirit, Mr. Blessing, but you know what happened at the Alamo.
Yeah. Them fellers killed a heap of Mexicans.
But they lost the battle.
Me and the boys, we worked hard to build what we got here.
Reluctantly, Blessing turned to his sons.
Tom, Bert, Jim, go gather the horses and mules. Them varmints may burn the house, but I'll be damned if they'll add our stock to their string. I hate to leave here without a fight. Where you reckon them Red Devils have been?
They were coming from the direction of Linville when we saw them.
Linville? I got a sister there, and her family. You don't reckon?
I don't know.
Everybody can't just up and run. There's bound to be somebody with the guts to stand and fight.
Maybe, if the Comanches didn't leave everybody dead behind them.
Maybe me and the boys can put some fighting in together. There's four of us to start.
Six. Mike and me. We'll go with you.
Webb looked to Shannon for silent confirmation. After they scattered their stock far off the trail of the approaching Comanches, they moved on toward Linville. They'd pushed their horses into a lope for short distances, then slowed to a trot to conserve the mount's strength. Webb could see the cloud of dust to the north, marking the location of the Comanche column. The oldest of the Blessing boys, Tom, drew up on the reins.
Listen! I think I hear shooting!
Webb first thought the Indians might have caught one of the families he and Shannon had warned, but he decided that was not the case.
Somebody's done let into them. Come on, boys. We're liable to miss the fight.
Webb gave Shannon a questioning glance.
Hell, preacher. Who wants to live to get old and decrepit?
They never managed to close the distance between themselves and the Blessings, but presently, through the dust, they could see a back-and-forth surging of men and horses. Webb reined up. He wanted to grasp the full situation before riding into the middle of it. He saw a large company of white men dismounted, shooting at horseback Indians who circled them. Farther ahead, the main column of Comanches hurried away with their women and children. The detached set of circling warriors fought a delaying action. Blessing and his sons had halted, watching the fight from 200 yards.
We'd probably all get killed if we was to try to break through. Maybe we can do them fellas more good from out here.
At least, by God, we can give them devils something else to be worrying about.
Webb dropped to one knee and aimed his rifle. A white cloud of smoke blossomed around the barrel. He could not see if he had hit anything. Some of the Indians immediately split off and charged toward the six men. Anticipating this, two of the Blessing boys had held their fire. While four reloaded, the pair took their time in aiming. A horse went down, and the charge broke up. The Indians zigzagged in a rough circle, reconsidering. By the time they decided to rush again, the guns were reloaded. Soon the larger column had moved well beyond the skirmish. The nearby Indians broke their circle and began to travel slowly in a westerly direction.
Whew, looks like they've had enough entertainment for a while. Let's go see how the boys yonder made out.
A rough count told Webb that the company was made up of more than 100 men. Most had managed to hang on to their horses through the fight, though a few animals were wounded, and at least a couple lay dead.
Welcome, men. You almost missed the skirmish.
Webb thought he knew the face.
Seems to me I've seen you at camp meeting.
You're a preacher, as I recollect. We're volunteers out of Victoria. We follow this bunch all the way from Linville.
Linville? What happened there?
They took the town by surprise. Killed several folks. Burned down just about everything. Ain't much left but ashes.
I have a sister in Linville.
Most of the people got away in boats. Like as not, she did too. The dead were mostly men folks, I think. They tarried too long, fighting a losing battle.
Y'all ain't giving up the fight, are you?
We haven't even started yet. We'll nip at their rear till more outfits catch up to us.
There's more on the way?
The alarm's been sent out in all directions. There'll be some ranging companies along, I expect.
The captain of the volunteers came forward.
I'd be pleased to have you men join us if you have no company of your own.
I ought to be seeing about my sister.
You go find Aunt Bess, Dad. Me and Bert and Jim will do the family share of the fighting.
I've always been proud of you boys. A man couldn't have asked for better.
Captain, we got cousins in Gonzales. They'd be mighty put out if they was to miss the main fight. Reckon we got time to go and fetch him?
You might run into Indians along the way.
It'd be their own fault they mess with us Blessings.
Well, till the ranger companies show up, there aren't enough of us here to do more than pester their rear guard a little. But if you can gather up some more help, go ahead.
Well, me and the preacher will go with you, Tom, just in case you do run into some Indians. All right, preacher?
You said it yourself. Who wants to get old and decrepit?
Riding at the rear of the long column, Buffalo Caller looked back toward the white men who trailed behind like wolves following a buffalo herd. Their pursuit had become something of a game, parry and thrust, feint and retreat, in an effort to draw warriors into a trap. After a couple of these episodes resulted in a few casualties, the Comanches had become slow about rising to the bait. Buffalo Caller saw no reason such a superior force should play the white man's game. The people had all the advantage. It appeared to him that the whites were trying to delay the Indian retreat by pecking at its edges. They probably hoped for reinforcements. He doubted that they could muster enough fighting men to mount any serious challenge against a force this strong. Should they try, it would only mean more scalps dangling from war lances, more celebration when the people were back on their home ground. Buffalo Caller would welcome a stiff fight. Linville had been so easy, he almost felt cheated. Swift as the antelope, kept looking back, sweat running from beneath the band of the white man's stovepipe hat he'd worn since he'd sacked the coastal town.
We should strike them like the lightning. Kill them all before they have time to catch a breath.
There is time enough. Let them become tired and hungry. Sooner or later, they will begin to straggle. Then we can cut them to pieces.
But they are growing stronger. More tables keep joining them.
All the more of them to die.
With just a few men, I could run them all the way back to the water.
Go then. I will marry your widow and give her many sons.
You have two wives already, and your seed produces only girls. You have no son except that Texan boy.
The boy is not your concern.
I will tell you again. That hair is an ill omen. It looks like blood. I had a dream last night. The boy will bring evil. If you do not have the stomach to do what must be done, let me.
You will not touch him.
Buffalo Caller pulled his knife as a warning, and Antelope roughly pulled his horse away and joined the other warriors. But a dark scowl said the question was not settled. Buffalo Caller knew their friendship, though of long standing, would not be enough to protect the boy. Antelope believed strongly in medicine and omens. He had a remarkable ability to sense the presence of dark spirits when no one else was aware of them. Buffalo Caller believed in medicine as strongly as anyone, but his guardian spirits often disagreed with Antelope's. Antelope claimed to carry the power of the badger, and certainly he possessed that animal's belligerent temperament. Still, Buffalo Caller sometimes wondered if Antelope was not misled by Coyote, the trickster. Antelope's implied threat began to play upon the mind of Buffalo Caller. To reassure himself that the boy was all right, he put his mount into a long trot, passing the rear guard and going around the massive herd of stolen horses and mules. The women and children rode near the head of the column, where they were considered safest from attack by the trailing Texans. He sought out Whippoorwill, the younger and prettier of his two wives, the one he had chosen to accompany him on this long journey. She carried the boy in front of her on a high-stepping sorrel mare taken from the Mexican traders at Victoria. The boy still wore his homespun clothes, now dirty and beginning to ravel from the stresses of traveling. He did not look Comanche, but the shirt and trousers would have to last until the band made its way back to the homeland. Then he could be put into something more suitable.
Is he all right? Has Antelope said anything to you about him?
Yes, this morning, as we broke camp. Antelope said the spirits came to him in a dream and told him we should kill the red hare before he brings death to us.
Watch out for him. Do not let him get close to the boy.
What if he is right? What if the red hare is bad medicine?
My spirits have told me no such thing. Antelope makes wind and thinks it's spirits speaking to him.
Satisfied for the time being, he dismounted and let his horse graze the dry grass. As he waited for the column to pass, he remembered his doubts when the council first decided to allow women and children to accompany this grand punitive excursion. Ordinarily, it would be considered too dangerous, but so many warriors had massed together that the expedition seemed secure enough to allow such luxury. It was argued that the outnumbered whites would fall like dry leaves in an autumn wind, and so far, they had. The rear guard came along after a time, and Buffalo Caller grasped his horse's mane, pulling himself up. His eyes met those of Antelope for a moment before Antelope looked away. What he saw there convinced him that once they reached home, he would have to remove his family from Antelope's reach. A warrior known as Feared by His Enemies pulled up beside him.
More white men have joined their brothers back there.
There are still far more of us than of them.
It has been 3 days, and they have not given up.
They will, but we will destroy them when we get back into our own country.
The next morning was the fourth since they had chased the boats into the big water. The unexpected approach of 4 Texan horsemen seemed more an affront than a threat. Surely they would turn back when they saw the full strength of the Comanche force. Antelope led the charge. The warriors turned back, rejoining the rest of the rear guard. But the Texans kept coming. From the flank, a second group of Texans broke out of a fringe of live oak timber and quickly halted, seeming surprised by the number of Indians they faced. This time, Buffalo Caller joined other warriors in pursuit. The Texans retreated, though one somehow lost his horse and ran after his companions afoot. In their haste to get away, they appeared unaware of his predicament. He turned with terror in his eyes to meet death as the warriors rode him down. Buffalo Caller dismounted to collect the dead man's scalp. But then, ahead of them, a larger Texan force plunged into the exposed flank of the main column. The panicked herd ran away over the prairie sod. Some of the pack animals lost their loads. Long bolts of colored cloth came unfolded, dragging along behind them in the dust and the grass.
Kill the devils!
Impossible! There could not possibly be that many Texans.
Buffalo Caller looked around with wide eyes, confusion giving way to fear. His wife and the red-haired boy were up there where the Texans were on the attack. It was his place to stand his ground and fight, but he could not. He had to see to Whippoorwill's safety and the boy's. He put his horse into a hard run, passing the rearguard warriors. Though the whites had trailed for 4 days, their sudden bold attack had taken the column by surprise. Just ahead, the women and children were fleeing, surrounded by a thin guard of warriors. Some were already falling behind and being swallowed up by the rapidly advancing Texans. The Comanches' supreme confidence seemed to have evaporated. They were caught up now in a wild rout, no longer an organized force, but 1,000 individuals running for their lives. Antelope appeared like a vengeful specter out of the choking dust. His stovepipe hat was gone, his face twisted in fury.
I told you! The red hair has brought this calamity down on us! He must die!
No!
Buffalo Caller fitted an arrow to the bowstring. He could not kill Antelope. For one Comanche to kill another was unthinkable, but he could kill Antelope's horse. Instead, his own horse faltered, then missed a stride. Buffalo Caller rolled away from him in the dry grass. He pushed to his feet, the dust burning his eyes. He felt around desperately for the fallen bow. He looked up, bow in hand, but saw Antelope nowhere. The warrior had disappeared in the brown cloud raised by all those pounding hooves. He tried to catch a riderless horse, but was bumped hard. On his knees, another loose horse leaped over him, a sharp hoof striking his head. His scalp burned like fire. He saw a Texan bearing down upon him, a pistol extended at arm's length. The blanket of darkness descended over Buffalo Caller, but not before he gave way to despair. He was powerless to save the red-haired boy from Antelope's vengeance. Warren Webb could only guess at the number of volunteers and ranging companies who had gathered to challenge the Comanche invaders, but he feared they were not enough. The new Republic of Texas had little in its national treasury except hope, and it could ill afford to pay the number of rangers it needed to patrol its broad frontier. He had never been this far inland, so the country was new to him. The word had been spread that all available Texas forces, organized ranging companies, as well as volunteers, would gather at Plum Creek, which lay ahead. There, win or lose, they would stage the confrontation before the Indians could reach their hill country sanctuaries. Shortly after dawn, scouts had come into camp to report the Indians were just a few miles away. Webb and Shannon had attached themselves to a group of volunteers headed by Captain Matthew Caldwell, known as Old Paint for the white splotches in his beard. The company was gathered around him. They knew him as a battle-seasoned veteran of the revolution against Mexico, a man always cocked and primed for a fight.
Boys, there are 1,000 Indians. They have our women and our children captives. But we are 87 strong, and I believe we can whip hell out of them. What should we do, boys? Shall we fight?
Better cinch your saddle up tight, preacher. We're fixing to have ourselves a run, by God.
But in which direction?
Webb took some comfort in the knowledge that Caldwell's 87 were only part of the force converging for the fight. It had been reported that Colonel Ed Burleson was on his way up from the Colorado with a large company, including Chief Placido and several Tonkawa Indians, blood enemies of the Comanche. But even so, the invaders would still be greatly superior in number. Though most of the men favored Caldwell, Old Paint exceeded command to Felix Houston, a major general of the Texas Army. Under Houston's orders, the Texans had moved into concealment to await Burleson's arrival. The Indians appeared first, a long column stretching across the prairie, people and animals moving in and out of the dust like spectral figures, seen a moment, then disappearing.
They have to know we're somewhere about because they've been trailed the whole way. Talk about arrogant. They must figure they can swat us away like so many horseflies.
Pride goeth before a fall.
He tried to make a rough count of the horses and mules, but found it impossible. There might have been 2,000, even 3. A considerable number carried plunder the Comanches had acquired at Victoria and Linville. Burleson arrived with his men. What caught Webb's attention most was the contingent of Tonkawas, all afoot and stripped to no more than breech-clout and moccasins, their bodies painted for war. They wore white cloths tied on their arms so the Texans would not mistake them for Comanches in the excitement of battle. Most did not know one Indian from another. fight had opened, though Webb could not see the action and had no idea which way the contest might be going. Suddenly, a contingent of Comanches charged upon Webb's group, but the Texans were ready to meet them.
Charge!
Their initial strategy was clear. Pin down the Texans while the main body escaped with the women and children, the booty-laden horses and mules. Webb had never seen a more splendid spectacle, savage though it was. One Indian cast aside an umbrella he had carried to shade himself from the sun. He came in a run, holding a war club. On his head was a beaver hat with red ribbon tied around the crown. A ribbon of the same color streamed from the horse's tail. Webb found himself so fascinated watching that he did not take aim. Luckily, Shannon was beside him.
You ain't gonna use that rifle, Webb. Give it to me. I'll tote my load.
Webb bore down on a warrior who wore an antelope horn headdress. Webb lost sight of the overall battle, for he was concentrating upon his own small part of it. Soon the confrontation was less a battle than a runaway. Unaccountably, the Comanches seemed to have been caught off balance and unprepared. Any semblance of unity was lost. The big caballada of horses and mules was scattering to the winds, many losing their packs, littering the open prairie with all manner of white man's store goods. Comanches, dead and dying, lay along the trail. Ahead of him, he saw an Indian woman on a sorrel mare holding a small boy in front of her. A Comanche warrior rushed to overtake her. A husband bound on protecting wife and child, Webb thought. He brought his rifle up, though it was next to useless from the back of a running horse. He felt a pang of conscience for having even considered leaving woman and child without a husband and father. He realized suddenly that the man was swinging a war club, and the woman was trying to avoid him. She leaned over the boy, holding her arm out to deflect the blow. Webb could not believe what he saw. The man was trying to kill the youngster. The mare stumbled, pitching woman and child. The warrior's speed carried him past them. He wheeled his horse about and started back. She tried to shield the boy with her body, then brought up a knife, brandishing it at the man. Webb had no time to consider options. He drove his horse forward to intercept the warrior, who seemed so intent on the boy that he did not see the larger enemy until it was too late. The Comanche's eyes met Webb's, and he raised the club. Momentum slammed the two horses together. Webb felt himself catapulted out of the saddle. He rolled and grabbed frantically at the rifle. He brought it up and pulled the trigger. But the impact had spilled powder from the pan. The Indian had managed to stay on his horse. He reined it around and came back, holding the club high. Webb instinctively raised the rifle, trying to let it take the blow. A stab of pain told him the club had broken his arm. Mike Shannon appeared suddenly, coming up behind the Comanche. Wild-eyed, he jammed the muzzle of his rifle against the painted body. Arm throbbing, Webb turned quickly to look for the woman. He saw her on hands and knees. The knife lay on the ground beside her right hand. The boy stood beside her, bewildered. Only then did Webb notice that the child's hair was red, his frightened eyes blue. He wore the homespun clothing typical in poor farm families. A white captive, Webb realized, probably taken in Victoria or Linville. He looked as if he might be 2 years old, perhaps three.
Come to me, lad.
The boy hesitated. The Indian woman reached toward him. Webb knew Comanches often killed their captives when they were under pressure, so he kicked the knife away. He lifted the boy with his right arm and turned to catch his horse. The youngster clung tightly to his neck. Shannon rode in close, pistol in hand. He gave the woman a hard look.
Spare her. Listen, she makes a move toward you. Got your arm busted, looks like. Better let me carry the boy. White, ain't he?
He leaned down and drew the lad up in front of him in the saddle.
No! Please!
The lad has people somewhere. He needs to be back with his own kind.
The mare had risen to her feet and was walking shakily. Webb motioned toward the woman, then toward the mare.
You best be slipping away while you can.
Shannon turned the boy away from her. She gave up and moved westward in the direction of the general runaway, though she kept looking back at the boy in Shannon's arms. The volunteer rode up, eyes ablaze with excitement, sweat running down his face into a stubble of beard. His hands were bloody, but the blood did not appear to be his own. He pointed toward the fleeing woman.
Ain't you gonna shoot her?
I never shoot women without I have to.
Indian women make babies, and babies grow up to do murder.
If you ain't gonna shoot her, I will.
Shannon set the boy down upon the ground and eased the muzzle of his rifle in the horseman's direction.
Do, and you'll answer to me.
You would shoot me over Comanche squaw.
I might. And then again, by God, I might just whoop the hell out of you.
One day her sons will come to take your scalp, and you'll wish you killed her before she born.
They got plenty of fighting men left up yonder if you're bent on more killing. Go get them.
The man lowered his weapon. The fight, what was still left of it, had swept on past.
I figure too. You taking Indian boys to raise, are you?
Look closer. He ain't an Indian.
Good thing he ain't. Because I'd be of a mind to kill him before he had a chance to grow up and kill me and mine.
With the volunteer gone, Shannon turned back to Webb.
Yonder's a bunch of men gathered. Maybe there's a doctor amongst them. Your arm needs looking after.
Webb carried a medical book in his saddlebags with his Bible and administered limited physical aid along his circuit, because real doctors were scarce in settlements beyond the main towns like San Antonio and Houston. But he doubted he had the fortitude to set his own broken bone. Shannon rode up to the small group of Texans.
Anybody recognize this young'un?
What's your name, lad? What do your folks call you? Your daddy and mama?
Davy.
What do they call your mama and your daddy?
Mama? Daddy?
Webb saw that further questions would yield nothing. The boy was too young to know his family name. Evening fell on the camp they shared with the Blessing Brothers and a small gathering of volunteer rangers in the service of the Republic. The arm throbbed, and Webb knew he was running a fever. August Burmeister had bound it around a temporary splint, a rough piece of live oak limb.
I am not doctor, but the arm will not crooked be.
Where'd you learn to do up a broken arm like that?
In the old country, in Westphalia. I was a soldier in the army.
Huh. How come you to be in Texas?
I did not like to be a soldier in the army. In the old country, they tell of Texas. When they do not watch, I walk out into the Netherland and the sea. On a boat, I come to Galveston to look for myself.
Hell of a sight you're seeing here. We gave them a royal whipping, by God. There'll be a trail of Comanche bones all the way up to the mountains. They'll study long before they ever come this far again.
The Tonkawa scouts who had accompanied the white men on their punitive mission were camped nearby. Webb wondered how one tribe could be induced to aid the Texans in their fight against other Indians. The only answer he could see was that they did not consider themselves to be of the same people, despite the fact that white men regarded them that way. The Tonkawas, a small and vulnerable tribe, saw the Texans as allies in their long struggle against domination by the stronger and far more numerous Comanches.
They're roasting meat over yonder. Did you notice that some of them dead Comanches had their limbs chopped off?
The Tonkawas had a reputation as cannibals, eating flesh from their enemies in ceremonial rites.
Praise God, they're our friends and not our enemies.
Whew. What are we gonna do with the red-haired boy, preacher?
Nothing we can do except ride back over the trail the Indians left and ask if anybody knows him.
Chances are that the Comanches killed his folks when they stole him.
If we can't turn up his family, we'll have to find somebody who will give him a good home.
Davy, is it? Nice name. He'll be a good-looking young'un when he gets his face washed. That rusty-colored hair means he'll be a fighter someday. Reckon he's Irish?
All I know is that he's not Comanche.
He'll be needing a woman's care. My Dora would be right pleased to keep him till we find his own folks.
And if we don't find them?
Dora always wanted a big family, but as you know, she ain't been able to bear. She'd take this young'un as her own and be glad for the chance.
I'd keep him myself, only I've got no wife to see after him. I couldn't take him on the circuit with me, and I couldn't leave him.
Then it's settled. This boy will be good company for Dora. We'll treat him like he was born to us and give him a good Christian raising. That's a promise, by God.
Colorado River, 1859.
As Rusty Shannon walked out to the pen, he saw the gate slumped half open, dead weight against its leather hinges. He had personally penned the mule team last night so he could get a daylight start in the field. The team had included a big gray mule named Old Zack, one of a pair Daddy Mike Shannon had brought home from the Mexican War. The mule was smart as paint, but it had never learned to untie a knot in a rawhide string or push open a heavy gate that always dragged the ground and strained a man's muscles to lift and move it. Leaning down to pick up the rawhide strip, he saw that it had been cut. He became aware of moccasin tracks, and his heartbeat quickened. Instinct made him look up, his gaze sweeping the open ground between the cabin and the river. His stomach, warm and full from a breakfast of coffee and cornbread, honey and venison, seemed to do a quick turnover.
Daddy! Daddy Mike!
Shannon came onto the open dog run, one arthritis knotted hand raised to shield his eyes from the rising sun. His graying whiskers had not felt a razor in a week or more. His thick gray hair was disheveled, for he'd not taken time to use a comb. He combed his hair only for company, and he had no reason to expect any.
Oh, it's all noise, young'un. Fox been amongst the chickens again.
Rusty was too old to be called young'un, but he supposed Mike would hold to the habit as long as he lived. No one knew Rusty's age exactly. The best guess was that he should be a year or so on the far side of 20.
Indians, Dad. Indians got the mules.
Ain't seen an Indian here since... Huh.
Michael Shannon hobbled out to meet Rusty and accompany him back to the corral. He'd come home from the Mexican War a dozen years ago with two mules and a sense of duty fulfilled. But he'd gone off on an Indian campaign a year or so ago and come home with a wounded leg that still pained him every day. He had had to lean heavily upon Rusty to work this farm that the state of Texas had awarded him for service. Texas had little cash to pay its volunteers, so they often went unpaid, despite the best intentions of governor and legislature. But it had land aplenty. Mother Dora came out onto the dog run, arms folded as if she were cold, thin shoulders slumped. She had been ill of late for no specific reason that met the eye. Preacher Webb was the nearest thing to a doctor within a day's ride when he was not off to some distant point carrying the scriptures to the farthermost settlers. Webb knew a lot about poultices and potions, but he could not fathom what was wrong with her.
Look at the moccasin tracks, Daddy Mike.
Them thieving rascals. Snuck up here in the night, by God, and got off with them mules without us hearing a thing. You didn't hear anything, did you?
No, sir. I'd have raised a holler.
It struck Rusty that the family's brown dog should have raised a ruckus. It never let so much as a raccoon approach the place at night without sounding an alarm. Sometimes, lacking anything else to bark at, it just barked at the moon. He found the dog lying in the grass, an arrow driven deeply into its body. It might have barked a little before it was struck, but no one in the cabin would have paid any attention if the racket stopped quickly. Mike reached for the arrow.
Comanche. Fool dog he was, but good company. We're not rich enough that we can afford to furnish work stock to the Comanche Nation. Ain't but one thing to do, and that's go after him, by God.
Afoot?
I saw our horses grazing down by the river just at sundown. Maybe them redskin thieves missed them in the dark. You go see.
Rusty had trotted 100 yards before it dawned on him that he was not armed. But it was unlikely the Indians still lingered. On a horse-stealing raid, they tended to strike hard and get away fast. He thought the chance of getting the mules back was about the same as finding a pot of gold down by the river. But he would not tell Mike so. He was as conservative with words as he was with the little bit of money that ever came into his hands. Visitors had spent the night at the Shannon farm and left the next day believing Rusty was deaf and mute. People not well acquainted with the family often assumed that Rusty had been born to it. Many did not know that Mike Shannon and Preacher Webb had taken him from the Comanches on the battlefield at Plum Creek. The minister had ridden many long miles and made a lot of inquiries before abandoning hope of identifying the boy. Mike and Mother Dora had regarded him as their own and gave him their family name, for he had none of his own. The only thing markedly different about Rusty was his reddish hair, which had gained him his nickname. Mike always said red hair went with a name like Shannon anyway. It was the Irish coming out. Hardly anyone except Mother Dora ever called him by the only name he had brought with him, David. She clung stubbornly to it, though everyone else had long since called him Rusty. At times, when he lay half asleep at night, Rusty could almost remember his true mother. Not so much what she looked like, for he could never quite conjure up her face, but something vague about the way she felt cradling him in her arms and the sound of her voice talking and singing to him. He remembered the warm and comforting feeling of love. It was not much, but it was enough to make him wonder, to give him a sense of loss, of something missed that he would never recover. It saddened him at times, even as he remained grateful to the Shannons. Had he been able to choose his parents, he would have wanted them in the Shannon image. Still, he often wondered who he really was. Though he made no claim to be a tracker, The broad trail led him to guess that the Comanches must have been riding or driving 75 to 100 horses and mules. A lot of people besides the Shannons had been set afoot. But he found the two Shannon horses grazing calmly 100 yards from the river. As Mike had said, the Indians had probably overlooked them in the dark. Rusty walked up to the gentler of the pair, a black much favored by Mike.
Oh, easy, Alamo, easy.
He rubbed the animal's shoulder, then he grabbed a handful of glossy mane. He guided the horse with his knees.
Come on, Alamo. You too, Goliath.